Chapter 4. There isn't enough information. John frowns at his comm, at the glowing display of all the notes he made while he was with the Firehand gang or researching their ties. Shorthand, coded, carefully tucked away amidst unrelated files, and Miles had handed it over without hesitation in a way that made John's stomach twist a little. The Mandalorians and the Jedi have been enemies for centuries. He wasn't expecting belief and help from them, regardless of the fact that he's marrying the Mandalore. Reaching out, John taps a finger against the display, flicks it sideways as a list of names rises to replace it. After a moment, he pulls up another, all the past and current members of the Firehands that he could find mention of, and pauses there, studying both listings, trying to feel out any connections. They exist, and he's sure of that. But seeing them takes a clear mind and a lack of expectation, and right now his head is just fuzzy enough to make it hard to concentrate. The Blue Rose Syndicate, he thinks, rubbing a hand over his eyes as he ducks its head. Two members from the Blue Rose joined the Firehand, but years apart. There's no proof that the Blue Rose is involved in supplying the Death Watch, and they mostly operate in the Inner Rim and the Core, but John has a feeling, an itching, unignorable feeling when he looks at those two names on the list. The needles give him the same feeling, even though they're supposedly opposed to the Death Watch, have had spats with the members before. When John closes his eyes, the links are there, waiting, obvious. Now he just has to prove them in the physical world. Reaching out, John slides his finger across the roster, trying to focus on nothing but his breathing, but it's hard. His whole chest still aches, and there's a pull in his gut that says he's not nearly as healed as he would like to be. Montross fought hard, and John had to take more hits than he thought to get close enough to kill him. It was worth it, because Montross had hurt too many people, needed to be put down, but John closes his eyes, presses a hand over his stomach, and tries to breathe through the pain. He's used to the hurt, and this shouldn't be enough to fog his thoughts. He should be better than this. But it's all so unfamiliar. This quiet room, the peace of the land outside, the ease of all the thoughts around him. There's a sense of discipline, of caution. But no one here is angry or alarmed or on edge, and John never stays in peaceful places. There's always somewhere else to go, always something else to do, always a sense in the Force pulling him onward. Not now, though. John is supposed to be here, right where he is. Breathing out, John opens his eyes, studying the list for another moment, then reaching out. He highlights a name in the Blue Rose column, but there's no thread to follow, no sense of certainty attached, just that one name, and John pulls back, pressing the knuckle of his thumb to his lips as he considers. He should... There's a knock on the door, loud and insistent, so unexpected that it makes John startle. He jerks around to look at it, then hesitates, not sure what to do. Jaster is gone, got dragged away by Miles earlier, and this is his room. Letting someone else in seems rude. Again, impatient, the knock sounds. "Open up, Jedi," a woman's voice calls. "I know you're in there." "Oh," John thinks, and closes his eyes for a brief moment, letting out a breath. That's what this is. "One moment," he says, loud enough to carry, and the knocking stops as the woman snorts. Carefully, gingerly, John shuts off the comm and eases himself off the bed, grimacing as he comes to his feet, but The exhaustion from keeping himself alive on the battlefield is still heavy in his bones, and healing himself seems like an impossible task right now. He just has to deal with the pain until he's a little more recovered. Making it to the door takes longer than he wants to admit, and John has to brace himself against the wall for a moment once he gets there, head spinning faintly. After a second, though, he reaches out, opening the door, and blinks at the figure on the other side. Tall and broad-shouldered, wearing black armor decorated with white and bearing a stylized red mythosaur skull, the woman waiting in the hall raises a brow at him, a sweep of her eyes taking him in from head to toe. "You're a Jedi?" she asks, sounding skeptical. "I didn't think they came in Vagabond." John wishes for his robes, his cloak, something to hide behind, but since he doesn't have them, he lifts his chin, meeting her eyes. "You're a Mandalorian," he counters. "I didn't think they came in blonde." Surprise flickers over her face, and she snorts loudly, tipping her head. "I have bad news for you about the Kalevalans, then," she says dryly, uncrossing her arms. "I'm Arla Fett." The adopted daughter of the Mandalore, John thinks, a little surprised, and takes a step back. "John Antilles," he returns, and Arla takes advantage of the gap to push into the room. She sets her helmet on the chest by the door with an air of complete familiarity, then turns, studying John again. John doesn't let it move him, doesn't react as he closes the door and steps back to lean against it, not sure how much longer his legs will hold him, but not willing to sit down and be so clearly vulnerable in front of a stranger. "Jedi Knight John Antilles," Arla says, like it's a test. John has no idea why they all seem to think he's a knight and not a master, but it's both a little amusing and a little relieving to realize that they haven't managed to find the Order's records of him. What records there are, at least, Dark Woman very carefully made sure that there were few references to him in the archives, and even fewer ways people could find him. Still, knight tends to be used as a very general sort of title for any Jedi, among those who don't know them better, and John isn't about to correct the misconception. "Yes," he allows, and Arla sighs a little, the curve of her mouth something rueful. "Well," she says, "at least Jaster didn't drag home another half-dead dire cat. A Jedi is probably an improvement." John blinks, caught off guard. "A dire cat?" he asks. With a snort, Arla steps forward, circling around to the side of him as she watches him closely. "Jaster tends to like dangerous things," she says, "even when they turn around and bite him." There's a sharp flicker, a wash of something like self-recrimination that spikes across her emotions, tired and a little angry, but worn with age. And now he's marrying the dangerous thing he dragged home, apparently. John doesn't move, doesn't react. He doesn't need to be watching her to be aware of her intent, and right now she's not a threat. Dangerous, but she's Mandalorian. It's to be expected. "It was the price," he says quietly. "I knew killing Montross would have a cost, but I chose to do it anyway." Arla is quiet for a moment, and then makes a sound of quiet amusement. "And I'm glad you did," she says. When John slants her a wary look, she shakes her head, then takes a few steps back, sinking down into one of the chairs by the window. There's a book on the table, the one Jaster was reading last night, and she runs her fingers over the cover, then says without looking up, "Montress was responsible for leading Jaster and my brother both into an ambush on Cordia 4, before they knew he was a traitor. He was angry that Jango and I had gotten positions as squad leaders for the mission, and he almost got Jaster killed. Jango and I were able to save him, but Montross needed to die for it." That tone is dispassionate, flat. John can feel that she means it, that there's no hesitation in her, no waver in her belief. And it's confusing in a different way than Jaster's certainty in the same matter, because Jaster is Mandalore. He's responsible for all of the true Mandalorians, has a duty to the whole movement, and it makes sense that he would take the actions of Montross, who was seeking to harm them, as an offense that merited death. Arla doesn't have that same duty, though. This is her response to her family being attacked, echoing the same bloody-minded ferocity as the Mandalore protecting his whole system, and that's almost unsettling. He was targeting civilians, John says in quiet explanation. The Order tries not to involve itself in Mandalorian affairs, but I couldn't stand by and watch. Arla's eyes narrow, thoughtful, as she watches him, and she leans back in her chair, stripping her gauntlets off deliberately. It wasn't an assigned mission, she says, like that's a test too. John shakes his head. He thinks about telling her he goes where the Force leads, not where the Order tells him, but he doesn't know how a Mandalorian would take that kind of thing, so he keeps it to himself. He seemed more important than the gang I had infiltrated, he says quietly. One of Arla's brows rises, and there's sharp interest on her face. Infiltration, she asks. That's your specialty. There isn't really a good way to classify himself. John hesitates, considering, and then finally shakes his head. Some of everything, he says, but I usually work alone. An understatement, but he lets it stand. Infiltration is easier like that. Arla hums, mild and uninflected, but John can read her rueful amusement clearly. Well, she says, the fact that you're used to acting might help with all of this. I'm supposed to take you to see the tailor as soon as possible. The medical droid get done with you yet, or are we waiting on her? She was here, John says, and considers how he feels, the distance to the bed, and how he's hesitating to cross that much ground. Breathes out and says, I won't be moving fast. That's why I'm here, and Miles didn't just give you directions. Arla checks her calm, then rises to her feet, tucking her gauntlets through her belt. She pauses there, considering John with a weight behind her gaze, and then says, I understand that this is my father's plan, Jedi, and that you have other duties that demand your loyalty. But if you harm him in any way, I'll show you precisely why Mandalorians are so good at killing Jedi. That dark ferocity vibrates through her words, even though they're steady. Protectiveness with a razor-sharp edge, furious and as solid as stone. It doesn't waver, doesn't bend, and John lets the heat of it curl around him and nods. I understand, he says, and that at least is true. He can understand what drives her to make the threat, the promise, can respect it. Arla holds his gaze for another long moment, then nods curtly. She picks up her helmet, tucking it under one arm, and then moves towards John. Deliberate and slow enough to make it clear this isn't part of the threat. I can carry you the way Jaster does, but we might give the rest of the super commandos the wrong idea, she says dryly. John grimaces faintly. Jaster picking him up when he's half dead or too injured to move is one thing, but resorting to that when he's perfectly conscious and in public makes him want to cringe. Something to lean on is enough, he says, and shifts so that Arla can brace her body against his and pull his arm over her shoulders. The stretch makes him wince a little as they shuffle, trying to figure out how to move together, but he finally gets his feet under himself, letting Arla take some of his weight, and is relieved when it doesn't hurt quite as much as standing upright on his own. First step accomplished, Arla says dryly, blowing a strand of blonde hair that's escaped from her braid out of her eyes. She's still carrying her helmet, so John silently reaches out, opening the door, and she makes a sound of amusement, steering him out and kicking it shut behind them. Thanks. What a way to get to know my future stepfather. John twitches, almost wants to duck away, except he can't, and it ends up being a skittery spook, like he's a shying horse that almost overbalances them both. Arla yelps and drops her helmet, almost tripping, and just manages to catch them on the edge of a decorative pedestal before they both hit the ground, her fingers hooked in the waistband of John's pants. He hisses at the wrench of movement as he's caught, pain radiating bright across his nerves and almost buckling his knees. Arla gets an arm around his waist before they can, though, hauls him upright again, and there's a second of silence as she stares at him. John ducks his head, hiding as best he can behind the fall of his hair, but he can feel the tide of her amusement rising, bright and effervescent. "Didn't think of that, did you?" she asks, on the edge of Mary, and the humor in her eyes is a wicked thing. "Less than 2 weeks until you're a father, Jedi." "Aye," John starts, then stops short, head empty of absolutely any response. He closes his mouth and swallows, and Arla takes one look at his expression and laughs. "Come on," she says, and hitches him up a little higher, grabbing her helmet from the floor and then dragging his arm over her shoulders again. Jango's horrifying, but he's not that horrifying. At least you got me, too. John grimaces, and not entirely from the pull of newly healed skin as they forge ahead. That wasn't part of the deal, he says, a little helplessly, and Arla snorts and pats his elbow consolingly. We've always been part of the deal, she says without sympathy. Don't worry, we're already self-sufficient. If Jaster picks up any more foundlings, those ones you can raise. Only if you want them raised as a Jedi, John counters, though he's honestly not even sure he could manage that much. He's bad with children. Arla makes a thoughtful sound, slanting him a look, though she's still smirking. It's a Mandalorian-trained Jedi who made the Darksaber, isn't it? Maybe a Jedi-trained Mandalorian could finally get it back from that bastard Tor. John blinks, startled. That was one legend the Dark Woman was entirely pleased to tell him, since she felt it proved several points. You mean Tar Vizsla, he says. The Darksaber is on Mandalore. It's still in use. Arla blinks back at him. You Jedi don't know? She asks, clearly equally surprised. No one but Tor knows where it is, but it's in possession of Clan Vizsla. That's one of the reasons the Death Watch has so many supporters. The Darksaber is supposed to mean that Clan Vizsla has the right to rule Mandalore. It vanished from the Jedi Temple after Tar's death, John says, frowning. There have been rumors ever since, but nothing that seemed reliable. My master once spent 2 years looking into stories of it. Arla snorts. Well, Mandalorians wouldn't spill that kind of thing to a Jedi, so I'm not surprised she didn't find anything. John is. If the truth existed, he would have expected Dark Woman to ferret it out of someone, because she's one of the best spies in the Order. But it is a Mandalorian matter, and if Tar Vizsla intended his clan to have it after his death, maybe something was lost between his intentions and the Order's actions. They would have passed it on otherwise. And if he didn't, well, something to look into. Though John doesn't quite have an idea what he'll do if it was stolen from the Order. If the Death Watch is using it, I think I'm allowed to object as a Jedi, John says, and Arla grimaces in agreement. Given that Tor wants to conquer the galaxy, I think you're allowed to object as a sentient, she says dryly. All right, left here. It's the fourth door on the right. Jaster didn't give the seamstress any orders about clothing, but I'm supposed to keep you from wearing neon pink and gold to the wedding. John doesn't quite pull a face, but it's a close thing. I can't wear my old robes, he asks, without much hope. The ones with the bloodstains? Ha. Merciless, Arla hauls him towards the seamstress's door. Don't look like that. Someone's going to think I'm taking you to an execution, not a fitting. John doesn't say he would prefer the former, but from the way Arla laughs when she glances at him, it's probably clear enough on his face. If that is another guest list, Jaster starts as the door opens, halfway to a threat. Miles drops the datapad on his desk without so much as a pause. You'll take it and like it, Mandalore, he says dryly, since you're not the one who has to calm all of these people and ask them to rearrange their schedules at the last minute for an incredibly important event. With a sigh, Jester sets aside the reports on Death Watch movements he was trying to make sense of and takes the other pad, glancing at the list and then immediately crossing out two names. They promptly flicker back to being uncrossed out, and Jester stares at them for a long moment, then raises a brow. "Some of them are non-negotiable," Miles says patiently, "including Clan Nast." Jester grimaces. "Someone should have taught them that descent from a former Mandalore does not give them the right to remain Mandalore 200 years later," he says, and crosses out another name. This one actually allows itself to be removed, and he breathes a quiet sigh of relief and quickly reads through the rest of the potential guests. "Clan Nost's Beskar mines are some of the most prolific in the system," Miles says, though Jester hardly needs a reminder when their clan leader makes sure to bring up that point every time they meet. "Be nice." Jester scoffs quietly. He didn't get the clans to follow him by being nice. He did it by offering them a new way of living that fell in line with old values, and they respect him for that, not for his ability to politic. "Any updates from medical?" he asks, rather than try to make that point, because Miles very rarely has any sympathy for wounds that are self-inflicted. "Before or after I caught Django trying to browbeat the Medroid into releasing him early?" Miles asks dryly, and Jester grimaces. "He's fine. I told him not to try it again. Given how he looked like a Tuca could have knocked him over, I think he'll actually listen this time." Jester shakes his head, though he's not overly surprised. Django likes to test his own limits and then push beyond them. "And John?" "Healing." Miles is watching him, Jester can feel it, but he doesn't look up and acknowledge the gaze. "The Medroid seemed pleased with his progress, so I sent Arla to get him fitted." She took the news of the wedding well, at least. But then, Arla has an ability to focus on advantages and benefits to the exclusion of most other things, and it's a fearsome one. As long as a connection to the Jedi is helping them, she'll support it. Django is less focused on assets. Jester is hoping that time in medical will give him the chance to come to terms with the news. "Anything more on those supply lines to Death Watch?" he asks, though that likely would have been the thing Miles led with if there was more information. And, predictably, Miles shakes his head, folding his arms over his chest as he leans against the corner of the desk. "I left your Jedi looking over his notes, but I couldn't read them, and he didn't seem to have anything new." For a moment, Jester considers the data pads on his desk, full of information from agents and allies and informants, things that no Jedi, no matter how well-informed, would have access to. There is always a hesitation about sharing too much, leaving his people vulnerable, but stopping the Death Watch is more important. John swore his life to Jester, and the fact that he still had lines, still would refuse to compromise his own morals, is nothing but a good sign. Jester has never cared for sycophants. It was one of the first things that repelled him from Tor Vizsla, who wants nothing else in his followers. That John still has a backbone, still has loyalty to something larger than his own life, makes Jester inclined to like him already. He thinks of waking, that careful shift in the body beneath him. Leaving, he'd thought, but then John had curled into the warmth, settled closer, and the soft way he sought out Jester's touch, combined with a flat refusal to compromise his values. Well, Jester is a simple man, but he's never been accused of bad taste. Finishing the guest list, Jester marks an extra name down and then hands it back, rising to his feet and selecting the most relevant pad. From the other side of the desk, there's a sound of surprise, and Miles asks with an edge of disbelief, "Clan Wren, they're sworn to Clan Vizsla, Mandalore, if you've forgotten." "Oh, are they? My mistake." Jester frowns, considering another pad, and then takes it as well, tucking both under his arm. When he glances up, Miles is giving him a flat look that Jester first learned to fear when they were teenagers. "It seemed a more expedient way of letting Tor know about my plans than simply sending him a comm." Miles looks down at the list, then back at Jester, and he seems entirely unconvinced. "You just want to poach the new Countess and make her a true Mandalorian." She seems like an intelligent and reasonable person, Jester allows. One who could be turned away from plans of conquering the galaxy with a rabble of thieves and traitors if presented with a reasonable alternative. Miles's sigh says that Jester makes his life far more stressful than it needs to be. I can contact one of the unallied clans to carry the message, but if this friendly overture loses us possible allies because we got their clan members shot, it will work, Jester says. And when Miles raises a brow at him, he smiles crookedly. I knew Ursa's mother. If her daughter has any of the honor that her mother did, she won't even consider harming a messenger just for carrying an invitation she doesn't like. Honor or no, she's still Death Watch, Miles says, but it's not precisely a protest. He watches Jester collect the last of the paperwork that needs his attention, and then says, Arla is perfectly capable of getting one Jedi fitted without your oversight. I'm well aware, Jester says dryly. I just want to leave what our sources reported with John and see what he makes of it. The odds that the Jedi Order know all of the intricacies of the Death Watch's movements are minuscule, but with our information, John might notice something. For a moment, Miles is quiet, his attention thoughtful. You're really planning to make it a marriage, he says after a long pause. Political, but... Jester frowns. Of course I am, he says, a trace of offense surfacing. I wouldn't have proposed a sham. That's not... Miles stops himself, shaking his head, and he's smiling a little crookedly. Sorry for doubting you, Mandalore. You're happy with the guest list? For the next hour until you bring me a new one? Yes. Jester tries to puzzle out what Miles was going to say, but he can't be sure. Miles is quick. Sees undercurrents where Jester tends to look at the river's course, and one of the reasons they work well together is that they're always on the same page, even when they're reading from separate books. Still, if it's important, Miles will tell him. There will only be a new one if everyone on this list refuses, Miles says, which isn't out of the question given what you're asking. Then it will be a very quiet wedding. Jester pauses at the doorway, glancing back. Is there anything else? Miles shakes his head. Don't let your daughter bully you, he says, smiling. Jester snorts. I'll just tell her Django tried to get out of bed, he counters, because that will be more than enough to turn Arla's righteous indignation on her brother. Raising a hand, he leaves the office, heading for the seamstress's workshop, and maybe it wouldn't be polite to intrude in normal circumstances, but given the point of this marriage, Jester assumes he'll be forgiven for involving himself. Besides, as much as he trusts Arla, leaving her alone with a Jedi, even a nominally allied one, for too long might not be the best idea. She's even-keeled and clever, but she has a cold temper, and strange things rouse it sometimes. Still, when Jester pauses outside the door, there's no sign of a fight. Instead, he can hear Arla laughing, a low voice, a woman's slightly higher tone. Brows rising, he wraps his knuckles against the door, then opens it and steps in. End of chapter 4.